JR4, add new construction to tax basis. Senate Bill 283, procedural changes on sale of tax foreclosure property. Senate Bill 316, exempt clergy from withholding. Senate Bill 398, exemption of farm tools. Senate Bill 906, state allotment procedure.
Okay, the committee will come to order. Senator Day has a motion.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 283 and Senate Bill 316, I move come from the table.
Okay, Senator Day moves that Senate Bill 283 and 316 be removed from the table. Is there objection? Quorum being present, no objection is so ordered. Okay, SJR 4. Mr. Jones?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Ira Jones, Assistant Attorney General of the Tax Division of the Department of Justice, here representing the Department of Revenue. At the conclusion of the last session, which you considered Senate Joint Resolution 4, there were several defects that were pointed out in the language that exists as subsection or paragraph in subsection 4 that's found on page 2, lines 4 through 8. One of the problems was that as that language appears, there's no way in which you could compute the amount of the increase in time to make it applicable to the tax base of that year. Therefore, you got to set it ahead of you. Another problem that came about was how do you define what new construction is? It wasn't really defined in the constitutional amendment. And if I remember correctly, your druthers would be that the definition of new construction be left up to the legislature to define. And the third point was that you would ask that the amendments be so changed so that that new construction not consist of any property that's in an urban renewal area, which is contributing, or the value of which is, or taxes on the value of which is contributing to the payment of indebtedness or operations of an urban renewal agency. In other words, since that doesn't go into making the tax rate, you didn't feel that that new construction should also be included in increasing the tax rate. So I have prepared for you on some amendments dated April 27, 1981. Amendments which I think will take care of all of those problems. Starts out by deleting on page 2 all of the existing language found in lines 4 through 8 and putting in the new language. The first sentence of which says, during the second fiscal year following the fiscal year in which the value of newly constructed real property has caused an increase in the true cash value of the taxable real property in a taxing unit over the true cash value of real property in the taxing unit as of the preceding January 1, the tax base of the taxing unit shall be increased. Now we're going to, in other words, increase the tax base in the second year following year in which this increase occurs. And then the second sentence says that tells about how you're going to increase the tax base. The increase shall be an amount equal to the equalized assessed value of the newly constructed property which created the increase in true cash value of the taxable real property of the taxing unit multiplied by the rate by the tax within the tax base of the taxing unit for the fiscal year in which the increase occurs, plus 6% of such amount. And again, this follows the way that other sections of the Constitution have for increasing the tax base when you annex new territory. So you will take the assessed value of this property, equalize assessed value of this newly constructed property, and you will multiply that by the tax rate for that year, and then add 6%. That will become the increase in the tax base in the second succeeding year, or the second year following the year in which the increase occurred.
Senator Trope.
Why the 6%? why not 8%, why not 4%?
Because tax basis of the Constitution increase, so say if you levy it all, 6% of the preceding year. So I was just keeping consistent with the rest of why you voted up the section.
Mr. Chairman.
Did you finish, Senator? Senator McFarland?
My question is about this question. This says shall increase 6%, and as I understand it, they have the option of increasing. It's true, nobody has ever refused to increase it 6%, but there's no, it's not mandatory. Am I not right?
Mr. Chairman, Senator McFarland, if the tax base is increased because of annexation, yes, it would be a mandatory increase in that year. Ordinarily, you have to levy the full amount of the tax base in order to get the increase, and you're right. In any other exception, except where you are actually by the Constitution causing an increase or something other than the levy of taxes, the language that's always been used is shall, and I assume they didn't want to make it here. Now, if they didn't levy all of the tax base that one year, during that one fiscal year, then they're back again to, it doesn't mean anything.
Beyond the 1 year, it doesn't mean anything anyway. I guess my question, though, is that under normal circumstances, what we really say is that people can increase that amount by 6% without going back to the voters each year. Is that not true?
And that's right.
That's what this 6% is about.
Saying that you're going to show increase over and above what they levied the last year plus 6% by this increase plus 6%.
See, it appears to me that this 6% increase should be the same kind of optional that it is in reference to the rest of the law. In other words, everybody can raise their tax base by 6%, or their taxing amount by 6% each year without going to the voters, but it's optional, it's not mandatory.
What we're doing is defining what that tax base is. Now, you don't have to levy the full amount of the tax base. That's why we're using the word shall. The tax base shall increase for that 1 year. Why that amount? Now, you don't have to levy up to that full amount.
For clarification purposes, if a taxing district is spending $4 million at a $100,000 tax base, each year, as they levy $4 million, that tax base automatically increases by 6%. Now, if in 1 year, for some reason, they did not need to levy a tax, would it then freeze as opposed to automatically being increased because they did not levy at least that amount?
It would be the last year in which they levied a tax within their tax base plus 6%. So they would lose 1.6% increase.
Yes. Okay. Now, Senator McFarland, you got?
I'm not sure. They don't have to. You can levy an amount that does not include that 6% increase anytime you want to.
They don't have to.
That'll still be the case with this.
Yes.
Of course. It's still a case.
Sure. And that will still be the case here, I believe. What we're doing is simply defining, making a definition as opposed to setting out an automatic increase.
Right. We're talking about how much the tax base will increase, not how much the levy will be levied.
Senator Day?
I wonder if I wanted to place a limit right after last sentence after amount. I were to put a new sentence in there that said, however, the increase here in authorized shall not exceed 15% of the tax base of the taxing. How do you think that would be?
Will not increase. I don't follow.
Well, if the increase is authorized, we're authorizing the increase in the tax base, right? Wonder if we said should not exceed 15% of the tax base of the taxing, in other words, of the previous year. How would you feel about that? Shall not. So there's a maximum that could go up.
Well, that should be done. That's going to further complicate. You're really saying two things. It's either going to increase the amount of the tax base or the amount of.
We're putting an outer limit. Outer lid on it is all I'm suggesting. Because you could have some gyrations that maybe could be unusual. I just don't know whether that's reasonable or not.
Yes, it could be said that another sentence, in no event shall a tax base in this
As a result of this provision.
As a result of this provision, exceed 50% of the previous year.
Okay.
This brings back to my question, and I hate to be difficult, but I thought I understood you until you said the last sentence of your explanation to me, and then it blew it all. The tax base does not increase 6% in a year when it is not used, does it?
No, it does not.
But this would increase whether they were using that tax base or not.
Just in that one year.
See, let's go back to not having that lid that he talked about put on this. And we say that we're going to incorporate new construction into the tax base, and we build Trojan. And the schools in the district don't even know how to spend all the money. But they have reduced their demands from what did it go down? In reality, it went from about 28% to 6% or some such kind of thing like that. It really dropped dramatically, and they still had money bulging out of every pocket, the Columbia district. Whenever you introduce a major piece of construction into this tax base, it really affects the whole thing.
What you're talking about is that the rate went down.
Right.
But the tax base is defined in so many dollars that we're levying in the preceding, the highest amount that you levied in preceding years. So we're talking about absolute dollar amounts.
All right, but they got all this money now, and the next year they don't want to raise that tax base again because they got more money already than they're using. So does that tax base automatically go up whether they use it or not?
It would just in the one year it would go up, and if they didn't use it in that year, then
you're talking about this. But I'm just talking about in general.
The tax base doesn't go up.
Like for 5 years after Trojan's introduced into their tax, it takes them 5 years to figure out where to spend all that money.
Well, but their tax base would not increase more than 6% a year in absolute dollars.
That's not what I'm asking you. Would it increase? Would it have to increase to 6%? It would not have to increase at all, would it?
Yes, the tax base would have to increase if they want more dollars to spend.
They don't want more dollars. Listen to what I'm saying. They built Trojan. They got more money than they want. They don't want to increase the tax base. It does not increase then, does it?
I read there's a difference between base and levy.
That I realize.
He's in a little hurt right now. Just let him alone. We'll see how he gets out of it.
I think it's going to be more fun to see how he gets out of it.
You want George to teach you anymore?
I don't know what Trojan is.
Two sessions will have more than that.
I'm sorry, George. I couldn't resist it.
Let's say the year before Trojan, that we had a district in which it was there, and they had a tax base of, say, $100,000.
Okay.
And they have a levy outside the tax base of another $100,000.
All right.
So a total of $200,000. Okay. Now, after Trojan, next year, the tax base would be $106,000. Now, the amount, if they wanted to levy any more than that, they'd have to go to the people and ask for how many dollars they wanted to vote. Now, let's assume that they decided that they only needed $206,000. In other words, their tax base plus an additional 100%, or 100,000. I doubt that most districts would be that lucky to get by with this, but assuming that they did. Now,
206.
Let's assume that...
206.
Try it,
206.
Yeah, you do better.
Let's assume that Trojan just doubled the value. And so, here we have a rate of $20 a thousand. This then would probably be just slightly more. It would be about $10+ per thousand. You see, because Trojan just doubled. double the true cash value of the property. And I say plus because we got $6,000 more in here than we're going to be, so it's going to be slightly more than $10 a thousand. But you see, the tax base is still only $106,000. And next year, the tax base will be 106% of this $106,000.
112 plus 6% of 6,000, yes. But let me ask you a question now. Go back up to where, after Trojan, you don't have, say we introduce this bill, and we added that $100,000 to the tax. Say we added $200,000 to the tax base.
Well, okay.
Now, wait a minute. Now, I've heard you out. And at the end of that, then, we have $306,000 for a tax base, or $300,000 for a tax base. And those people don't want any more money. They don't want the tax base to go up anymore. They don't have any levy over the tax base. The tax base is all they're going to use, and they don't even want to increase that. They don't have to, do they?
No, they don't have to.
Okay.
But they could increase.
Then why do we put this language in here? It says they have to.
Well, we're describing what a tax base is. We're not describing what they have to do.
Well, why do we add the 6%?
To get that increase in value, not the same as...
Even if they don't want it?
...as a 6% here.
But suppose they don't want it that much.
That is where Senator Day's idea came in and said, okay, we're still only going to let this tax base increase by not more than 15%. So the maximum that the tax base could come would be $115,000, even though the amount of tax base here would increase, I'm not sure what it would be, but probably be something like
that. I hate to dismiss you. That really wasn't original with Senator Day.
I didn't say it was.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Have you finished, Senator McFarland?
Probably not, but go ahead.
Okay. Senator Truitt, I think, had a question a while ago.
I think Senator Truitt said.
Okay, Senator Truitt said, go ahead.
I'm on the far by night.
Yeah, go ahead.
All right, now we're talking about a Trojan, which is not too labor intensive. But what if we had Tektronix move in there with the same value that call for lot of school addition to take care of all the kids in the area? Would you want to put a 15% limitation on that type of an installation? That's my question.
Mm-hmm. Well,
especially putting it in the Constitution.
It's not always going to be necessarily a Trojan bill.
Senator Hanlon.
Chairman, all these concerns lead to one thing. Two things, actually. It would seem to me that in the year after Trojan, if there were a massive increase in the assessed value, I think we would not want to be put in a position of automatically creating a levy that exceeded anything that the people had ever approved.
Of course.
But not denying them the right to exceed that. If in the case of Senator Jernstedt, that's the case, something did happen that they wanted to. So what that would mean, I would think, in the year after Trojan, nothing can happen there that can exceed what they approved in the year before, 200,000. So instead of saying 15% limitation or some other limitation, just say that in the second year or whatever year we're talking about, the increase in assessed value cannot permit levy to exceed something that had been approved by the people in the prior year, or perhaps one of the three prior years.
Okay. That would be another.
That's another. So that the tax base in this case would be limited to, let's say, either the 200,000 or the 206, because the 6,000 would be, they could levy that without a vote if that became a new tax base. Their last operating budget, or the highest in the last 3 years, or, but see, that's another one of those wrinkles you get into, is if you set it to 1 year, then if a government has a happenstance, which is then followed by this, that system is like the A and B ballot system, then it doesn't necessarily strike true with the current situation. That would be a That sounds reasonable on the surface to limit it to an approved total levy amount.
And then you could decide whether or not you wanted to permit this to grow.
Yeah.
If you wanted to go to the people for something in addition to that.
Well,
is that what you're saying?
If you wanted to restrict this tax base, we'll put the hypothetical over here, but let's say that it went into effect, and assuming that I think that it would almost increase the tax base under this bill by about $6,000, for my example. I'm not sure. I can put it on a calculator. But whether you would want to limit this then to $200,000, or whether you'd want to limit it to $212,000, in other words, or something else.
Well, I think the idea of a tax base is to bring people up to a current operating level and then applying the 6% to it. So I would think, in keeping with that theory, instead of starting out with an outdated tax base, you'd want to bring it up to current operating level.
So that the levy.
And I don't know what is magic about 6%. I think the framer of the original Constitution, somebody asked me about it. And the most off-quoted answer I heard to that is it seemed like a good idea at the time.
Yeah. Senator Day.
Well, you've got two type facts. When you have a situation like Trojan, that is, was not labor intensive, but it was great in yielding revenue. You had a school district that still, sure, there were new jobs there, but they weren't, you know, it wasn't impacting that school district like a Tektronix who came in and went from, 50 or so people up to 1,500 or 2,500. Of course, Senator Trow down in his area has the Hewlett Packard, except that about 75% of those jobs came from the local area. It might have not necessarily impacted any one school district. I don't know, but you could have that kind of impact in a new area, particularly if it was a smaller community over eastern Oregon or in the attract. Well, then, even if you had it limited the tax base, or if we followed your example, they'd probably still go for a levy because they'd still have to accelerate that. So they'd be in a levy situation plus a tax base anyway. So that's why I think that the safeguard, the fact situation I'm looking at is if they don't have a large impact, to allow that to just get out of hand and go pell-mell, particularly when there wasn't a real impact upon the schools. It's just that they got a tax base or rewarded for our tax base. It seemed that that was a safeguard I was concerned about, because I think in most fact situations, if you saw a real school situation, they'd be in a tax base plus a limit. I think they would. I think they'd have to probably go for both.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Trump.
As I've seen the amendment, it's a statement, however, the increase herein authorized shall not exceed 15% of the tax base of the taxing unit.
Yeah.
What I'd like to do so that would apply to something like a Trojan, but would not apply to something where there was substantial additional burden on a community because is to add a clause, unless the voters of the district approve the maximum amount allowable. That would allow the voters then.
Excuse me, would that in essence...
My only concern is that we get voter approval and we don't set up anything that
would... Would they, by doing that, just set a new tax base?
Well, this 15% was not, if they voted in favor of it, whether they would just go to this 15% limitation would not be in effect if they voted.
That's what he's saying. That's fairly reasonable.
It just allows...
Approve the maximum amount, what, Cliff?
Okay.
What was the rest of your amendment?
I would like to
play with the language, unless the voters of the district
approve. Ira, do you understand that, the intent of that additional clause?
And there would have to be also something put in there that this would be outside of the prohibition of tax base elections.
That's right.
Okay. Section 5 of the Constitution, because that's on the statewide general or primary election that in all years.
See, I bet you most fact situation, if you look at this, would be in a situation where your schools are being inundated, you see. The Trojan example, I would think, would be one of the more rare ones. It's a classic example, but I think it's a rare one. It's an exception. Most of the time, they'd be on the other side.
Okay. Could you work on that language for tomorrow's meeting, Ira? Okay. Yes. We'll get you a copy. Okay.
Now, may I go on?
Bill, if you've got something right now, come on out.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is William Bain with the Oregon Association of County Assessors. I just wanted to say a few things. Senator Day made a point, I think, that the Trojan is the exception rather than the rule. I would guess that most of the time you'd be talking about a Trojan situation in a single large plant. You might want to think about that as one of the kinds of limiting things in terms of percentage increase. There's nothing in the language that I would perceive as an assessor that would prohibit a district from levying less than that increased tax base, just like it is under the present law. So you could always levy less than that. And
I think the point.
Then the other thing that I wanted to just say just very briefly is that I think part of the definition of the value of the new construction value may help solve that, because you have the construction in progress statute. If you tie it back to assessment definition of new construction, that value that's otherwise property taxable, you will get an incremental effect for a large plant, for large construction that impacts the tax basis. But tying that definition of the new construction value back to otherwise property taxable, a real property value, because of some of the other provisions that you already have in the valuation processes in tax law.
Thank you. In regard to that, is there language in this, if this was to be adopted, given all the definition of construction in progress or anything, that could be interpreted to define construction if the legislature should fail to do so?
Well, the way I have this drafted, which is the next sentence we were getting to,
okay.
I'm putting the shall in there as much, I guess, as the Constitution can direct the legislature to do anything like
that. I want to follow that later.
it may sound peculiar to make that kind of a statement, but a state constitution is a limitation on the legislature, not a grant of power. And you always got problems whenever you put in a limitation document something that talks about instructing somebody to do something in terms like we're giving them a grant of power. Always have this doubt in the back of your mind. Well, now, can you really instruct them to do it? Here, I think that you can, because you are saying first you're finding how this limitation may increase. And then the last sentence says, for purposes of this paragraph, new construction shall be defined by the legislature, but shall not include new construction in an urban renewal project as described in Article 9, Section 1C of this Constitution and statutes relating thereto. If tax on any portion of the cash value or equalized value is used to pay any urban renewal indebtedness or operating costs. So that this would say that value that accrues inside of an urban renewal area, all the money of which goes to pay off the indebtedness project is finished, that value will not be considered new construction for increasing the tax base. And certainly at the time that bonded and indebtedness and operating costs are all paid, that no longer would be new construction, and I assume that district or those districts would not automatically get a new tax base at the time that property went on the roll. All they would do is be starting to get a much reduced property rate, but it would not give them new authority to levy taxes.
Senator
Trump. Is urban renewal indebtedness defined adequately so that there won't be any problems?
Yes, in the statutes, it very definitely is. Urban renewal was actually what is used. Indebtedness also was used in Article 9, Section 1C.
Does that mean public indebtedness?
he said that it wouldn't be new construction.
Public body indebtedness rather than private indebtedness.
That would be indebtedness of the urban renewal agency.
Excluding construction until it's released.
You're satisfied.
That'd be a nice wording to add down here, that you pick it up when it's released. We could probably define it that way, though, and then it comes in a lot.
Article 9, Section 1C actually gives the term urban renewal in it, permitting that type of financing.
Okay, Ira, if it was the desire of the committee to have that new construction's effect on the tax base delayed until the end of the bond period, or until it went on the rolls, would you have to change this, or would that be carried in the accompanying legislation?
No, I would have to change this. And that would be a tremendous job. I'm thinking of what happened in the South Auditorium urban renewal area in Portland. As I recall, I think that started in almost before I became
that items owned or in possession of a taxpayer used in agricultural operations, and therefore would be exempt. The second case was a family co-op that has a grain elevator, and they, of course, the family stores, the family members store grain there, and they also lease or allow others to use it for a fee. And in this case, it was a 90,000 bushel elevator that had about $10,000 worth of equipment, and it was on taxable personal property.
Okay, just a minute. If that being the case, the assessors, if a family farm owns that warehouse, uses one quarter of it, but uses three quarters of it commercially, is the whole thing on the tax rolls at 100%? Or do you try to determine what percentage of it's used in that particular, or is it just considered a commercial operation? Thanks, Kirby.
My understanding is that in this case that all of that value is on the roll, and secondly that this is a case, if you look at the original bill, which contains some of the original language of the law, that the things, the personal property involved in storage are past the point of harvesting of farm crops, and therefore is more fully taxable. In other words, the current language there in subparagraph A says, inventory means farm machinery and equipment used in planting, raising, cultivating, or harvesting of farm crops. Well, this is personal property that's not used in any of those. It's used in the storage of them after they've been harvested. And so therefore, they are taxable. And in particular, in the Dash 4 amendments, we have put in there, after harvesting, conserving, or placing in storage, because in some counties, where they have brought, primarily, my understanding was where they're drawing that line, is that equipment which is taking the harvested crops and putting it into storage is being exempted, but once it's in storage, that's where the line is drawn.
Okay, so where is that language?
That's in Dash 4, the very first part of those amendments. It says, after the first or, insert a comma, and after, or delete the first or, and insert a comma, and after harvesting, insert or placing in storage.
Oh, okay.
So that on the original bill there, it would say farm machinery and equipment used in planting, raising, cultivating, harvesting, or placing into storage of farm crops. But the equipment used in the storage itself would not be. And that.
What about taking it out of storage?
Well, the feeling there was, I thought, that the same equipment is used for both. That is currently the way they're treating that right now. And that was the question. came out of those original.
And that's kind of the current status of that situation right now. It would maintain that?
Right, that was my understanding.
Okay, but it would, okay, but it would tend to clarify the other tools and machinery and items.
Right, that's in the dash four.
Yeah.
That was in the original set. What we thought what we were trying to do was to
okay, and 5 and 6 are about the same?
Well, the only difference between 5 and 6 is that office equipment is included as exempt in 6 and not exempt in 5.
Okay.
And that probably makes little practical difference. I think most, there is already, I think it's $1,000, 2,000, first 2,000 exempt anyway. If you have less than 2,000, the personal property role, they can, the assessor can choose not to place it on the roll.
Okay. Questions?
I'm going to move amendment number 4.
Okay. Senator Day would move amendment number 4. Okay. It's dated 4181.
398-4, 4181 to Senate Bill 398.
Okay. Jim, thank you very much, Jim. Don, do you want to say anything about the effect of this? The okay. Okay. Thank you. Anybody from the assessors have anything to comment on? Further discussion. Okay. Is there objection to Senator Day's motion to use the amendment labeled dash 4? Being no objection, is so ordered.
Move to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Okay. Was that what you were going to do?
Oh, I beg your pardon. Go ahead. It's your bill.
Okay. Senator Trow moves.
It's your bill, isn't it?
Senate Bill 398 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Clerk will call the roll.
Yes, that's right. All of our board.
Oh, is it? Are we all on?
Senator Hanlon.
Okay.
Who are you calling? Senator Hanlon?
Aye.
Go ahead.
Senator Jordan.
Aye.
Senator McFarland.
Aye.
Senator Trow.
Aye.
Senator Day.
Aye.
Senator Powell.
Aye. Motion's adopted. Senate Bill 906, the allotment procedure. Rich. Okay, Rick, Mr. Yunker, are you back there? Are you, wake up. Come on up and take the stand. We're going to whip
Put
right
your right hand
this.
Up.
As I understand it, I was gone for this hearing. As I understand, the amendments prepared to 906 would make it a notice requirement. Is that about it? Rich, why don't you run us through what it does, and then we can ask them questions.
Okay, in the original draft, then you have a small set of amendments that go with it. Labeled 421, 81, 34, per M, 44. And in the original bill, there is required if the deficit that's faced is less than 2%, that a notice is given to the legislature, public notice, and that within 25 days after the notice is given, the governor can implement his plan of solving the deficit. But within 15 days after receipt, within that 25, if the legislature responds that they're going to call themselves into special session, then that would suspend the governor's budget balancing program. The second part of the original draft in Section 2 would then require the governor just to submit a plan to the legislature if the potential deficit was greater than 2%. Okay, so then you had a choice of really coming into special session or the governor calling you into special session. Now, in hearings on the bill then, there was discussion because Section 2 required a special session, either the governor to call you or you to call yourself into session that maybe you did not want to do that. So you ask for language to be drawn to take out Section 2, and that's line 4 of your amendment, delete line 16 through 18. Then also you wanted then to take out the 2% trigger, because all you wanted to do then is have a public notice process. So you wanted to take out in line 6, no more than 2%. So that's been deleted in line 3. And then that means you renumber section 1 in line 5. So what the amendments will do to the bill is leave the bill as a process of public notice, where the governor, if under his process of reviewing the revenue estimates and dealing with the budget, if he decides that there is not going to be sufficient revenues to cover the deficit, to cover the expenditures, that he then would have to provide public notice 25 days prior to the effective date of implementing that plan, and the legislature would have some 15 days within that 25 days to respond if they cared to call themselves in a special session and not have the governor's program go into effect.
Okay, I have three questions, I guess. First of all, Mr. Yonker, the 25-day notice, is that, would that be a problem of any kind?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to go back to the experience we had last summer with the schedule. Through the allotment process, about 2% in June 1980, and explain just very briefly how the process works, and I think that's the fairest answer I can give. The minute we thought we had a revenue problem, we were on the phone to agencies telling that day, on the phone to legislators that day, telling them that we thought we had a problem. And as you know, every quarter the allotment process comes in and is looked at and is revised. And we are unscheduling where we feel appropriate every quarter during the biennium, whether there's an automatic across the board unscheduling or not. So it's, this is a continual process. When we decide that we're going to have the law only allows for across the board scheduling, the mechanism you're talking about, we tell them up front that we're planning on doing that immediately. We also tell them up front that anything that we've unscheduled previously during the year, that's not going to spend the money, we're going to put a freeze on it, and then we go from there. In other words, in the Reagan administration is in the same kind of problem right now. You've got to take action immediately, and then you start negotiating the been too harsh restoring some of those unscheduled money. As far as 25 days before any final decision, that's fine. What we would be doing is putting people on notice right up front on day one, and then during that time period, if we
look
find
the
parents,
you
whatever, we say, okay, now you can reschedule.
Yeah.
You can start by taking action.
Do you see the 25 days as possibly tying the hands of the executive in the case of a very rapid emergency? Now, I'm asking you this question expecting that this might be necessary. So we may have some experience with this in the very near future. Now, I'm talking about being able to act within a week or so, can you do that with existing avenues without going through the allotment process? I guess what I'm just wanting, I want a yes or no answer. Will that 25-day requirement tie the hands and prevent you under dire circumstances from handling an emergency? Because as I understand this, regardless of what the legislative leadership said back, said, no, we're not going to meet, you'd still have to wait 25 days. You have every agency head, every agency on board saying, yeah, but you could not, that the reductions could not become effective for 25 days.
Well, that's a problem, and we think the existing system is better. But, again, as the way it's working now, we would be making those reductions on day one. What we're talking about here is closing down a program or something. We wouldn't make any irreversible decisions for 25 days, and I think,
no, he's not.
I think, with that understanding, but we're going to tell agencies on day one to plan on this happening and take action immediately.
Okay.
Okay. So you, this language would not keep you from meeting a rapid emergency?
I think the other fairest answer is if we're talking about a situation that's so severe that we would be forced to notify a school to close down or something, we want the legislature there immediately to, I don't think.
Okay, so your answer is no, you would be able to handle it. And if it was that severe, you would have us back. Okay. Well, these guys are hard to get answers out. I just listened to some tapes the other day from the Treasury.
He'd rather have nothing at all, but he has to admit that this is workable. That's what he was saying 20 minutes ago.
I can put the revenue stuff.
No, I don't want to go into it. I think it's a, you mean a timeline?
Well, I was just meaning, if you look at when the forecast came in June of last year, that the $50 million forecast, when then the second forecast came, in July, I don't remember the exact dates, but it's something like the governor's office gave the forecast of a $50 million deficit, something like June 7th, 1980. Then July 17th. Then July 17th, 1980. They gave the second forecast of an additional 150. You met August 5th, 6th. You had that kind of timeline, and there had to be some time in here when the governor office knew of the 50 coming in.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's really dealing somewhat with that kind of, it seems that's 2 months day to day.
Okay.
Move the amendments, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, just prior to that, the 15th day, that is the legislature, presiding officers of both houses have 15 days in which to respond. Is that it? But they need not set necessarily a date for that. Now, would their response say, yes, we're going to meet, stop the governor from using the powers here, and then they say, yes, we're going to meet, but it's going to be next January? Okay, an emergency session. But again, what I'm getting at, the governor says, I want to use the allotment process, and this is my plan. Legislative leaders do not feel the same urgency. So they say, they invoke their rights under here and say, yes, it's now August. They say, yes, we're going to meet in an emergency session in December. Okay, now you've got a disagreement between the executive and the legislative branch. Would the legislators' response, yes, we're going to meet in an emergency session, it's not a regular session, and it will be an emergency at that time, maybe.
Well, if the legislature did that, the governor has the right to call them in anyway.
Yes.
Okay. All he'd do is call them in.
Okay.
Say, oh, no, you're not but, meeting that week.
But the plan, okay, but the okay, so we will be taking that much of the governor's authority away. We may force him.
Oh, I don't think this is any great big challenge. Yeah. Give some orderly procedure that.
I can foresee, however, a circumstance where the legislative leadership would disagree with the executive on this, particularly in the kind of times I see forthcoming, of great uncertainty. And the executive may say, look, I want to play on the side of caution, and I'd like to cut back 2% right now. Legislators say, now, wait a minute. That's our budget you're fooling with. Let's wait a couple months and see what's going to happen. And so you're into the situation. Now the governor is faced with a situation of calling a hostile legislature into session. I kind of like the idea.
That's right. Well, I think there's a media there that, first of all, you get it. You may not want one, you know, or you may want to talk it over.
Yeah.
You may decide after talking over. Let's go ahead.
Yeah.
Move the amendments.
Okay. Sarah Ann, did you have something before I accept these motions?
I was wondering if the chair would entertain a motion to table the bill.
Oh, well, let's amend it first. Okay. Senator Trow moves the amendments. Is there objection to the amendments stated 42181 from Legislative Council SB 906-1? Rick, did you have something? Okay. Okay. Is there objection? Being no objection, that'll be so ordered.
Senator Drill. Before he moves to lay it on the table, okay. Could I ask him why he's going to do that? I don't
say okay. Not available, but okay. Rick, did you have something you wanted to add before we move on? No, okay.
I have no
objection.
I'd like to find out.
Okay, Mr. Younger.
Just two things that I feel that I owe the committee.
Yes.
One is that we did look at this. The committee asked us to go back and talk to the governor about the bill. He did not have amendments in front of him. He did not support the bill in its original form. And I think that was known, but I wanted to be sure it wasn't.
I think what he's trying to say is the legislation may be playing into the hands of a hostile governor. Okay.
Secondly,
okay. Go ahead and
ask, do the amendments make it any more palatable for him?
I think they make it better, yes.
But palatable, chewable, will he veto it?
All governors are this way, regardless of party.
Okay.
I understand it. Go ahead.
The second thing is that I understand there was some concern about the reduction of federal funds. I'm not sure that this bill will work to anybody's benefit if we're talking about reduction of federal funds. And I don't know whether that's going to work or not.
Well, it won't unless funds appropriated by this assembly from the general fund are going to be manipulated in some way as a result of that, and that's highly unlikely because he doesn't have the authority to grab them out of one and throw them in the other. So it is highly unlikely that it would resolve that. However, I've only heard rumors coming from the Department of Revenue, and they're only rumors. But, you know, times are uncertain as far as income to the general fund. Okay, Senator Hanlon, did you have something?
Well, I don't have a hatchet out for this, but I thought by way of testing the water, I would move that Senate Bill 906 to the table.
You make that motion? You want to throw that out? Okay. Senator Hanlon moves that the committee lay Senate Bill 906 on the table. Do you want to discuss it? You don't want to tell us why?
I already asked that.
Okay. Sometimes motions are more debatable than you think.
Depends on the committee.
Just let you know what's going on. Okay. The motion before the committee, then, is whether or not to lay Senate Bill 906 on the table. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Hanlon?
Aye.
Senator Jernstead?
Aye.
Senator McFarland?
No.
Senator Monroe?
No.
Senator Trow?
No.
Senator Day?
No.
Senator
Powell? No. Motion fails.
The bill out with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Day moves Senate Bill 906 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. That's
discussion, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Monroe.
Chair.
Basically, all this is now that we've amended it, is a mandate for notice.
That's right.
Mandates that the governor notify the legislature when he anticipates making these kinds of cuts. I think that that's an appropriate function. It doesn't challenge the separation of powers in any way. It just keeps the lines of communication open between the two very important branches of government, the executive and the legislative. And for that reason, I think, as amended, it's an excellent bill.
Chairman.
Senator Day.
Well, the reason I had some interest in this is that I guess I've been in a special session every time I've served here, almost every time. The first year I got back on it, appointed basis, I was down here in a special session. I don't even remember the issue, but I was here. But to make a long story short, I just believe that we're going to be headed. We may have two more sessions before this biennium are up. And I think there ought to be some procedure, and that is no criticism of the governor during last year, because I think they did a super job. But I think we ought to at least know what that time frame is. Okay.
Okay. The clerk will call the roll on Senator Day's motion.
Senator Hanlon?
No.
Senator Jernstead?
Aye.
Senator McFarland?
Aye.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Senator Trow?
Aye.
Senator Day?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye. Motion adopted. Okay, tomorrow, meeting at 1:30 again, I have... We'll have important legislation up this Thursday, isn't it, Rich? When we're going to try to hear the tax law, Oregon law versus federal code, and some separating a bill that the governor's asked us to introduce, and that's going to be important. So Also, tomorrow at the beginning of our meeting, we will act on SJR 4 and Senate Bill 283.